Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. I have had the pleasure of talking to some of the leading authors, artists, activists, and change makers of our time on this podcast. And I want to personally thank you for subscribing, listening, and sharing 100 plus episodes over 100,000 times. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy. And I look forward to more conversations with those important voices that will bring clarity to the situation we find ourselves in as we move toward November of 2024. If you appreciate these conversations and my cultural and political commentary, please subscribe to this podcast, In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, on your favorite platform, and to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. I'd really appreciate the help. Thank you.
It ought to be just logical and obvious to us that women are never going to be able to share fully in opportunities at work, including opportunities to advance, if men are not sharing more fully at home.
Hi, my name is Frank Schaefer, and this is a podcast and a live stream called In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, first as a Facebook live stream, then on YouTube and all those places podcasts go. For those of you who watch this who want to get in touch with or learn more about our guests today, we always post links to them, to their books, to their websites, to whatever else connects folks to them, so you don't have to madly scribble if you hear something that you'd like to follow up on. We're going to help you do that. And forgive me, everybody, but I am going to be peering at the screen instead of making eye contact for a minute because I'm going to read from two fairly lengthy introductions to our guests, and I don't have my reading glasses on. In a moment, you're going to see an arm come in mysteriously. That'll be my wife, Jeannie, handing me the cup of coffee I did not get moments ago because I was cooking lunch for three of my five grandchildren. So we're in the midst of a real day here. This is not just talking heads. This is actual life. So I'm going to look at the screen and talk about who's with us today. We are in conversation with Good Guys and Athena Rising authors, David Smith and Brad Johnson, exploring the importance and the meaning of male allyship or allyship in the context of particularly gender equity, which is where I met these gentlemen because we were all on a call with the WBC, which is the Women's Business Collaborative. They were on a panel. I was watching. I got in contact with them and said, hey, I would love to interview you on this subject. David Smith is a PhD and associate professor at the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School and a former Navy pilot. Brad Johnson, PhD, is professor of psychology in the Department of Leadership, Ethics, and Law at the United States Naval Academy, and a faculty associate in the Graduate School of Education at Johns Hopkins University. And here comes my coffee. Thank you, Jeannie. They are the co-authors of the book, Good Guys, How Men Can Be Better Allies for Women in the Workplace. Did I catch all of that? Did I misread anything? Have I mispronounced your names? Are we all set here, David and Brad? Are we okay?
Right on the mark, Frank. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So anyway, thank you for being with me. I mentioned that we met in the context of the WBC, the Women's Business Collaborative, Edie Fraser and other friends who introduced us, I guess, by putting that together. I'm an author. We all don't know each other formally. I've written a number of novels. I've written nonfiction, biographical nonfiction, and so forth. And what brings me into the context of this discussion is that my last book, which is not what we're here to talk about today, so this will be the last time I mention it, but it's why we're talking today, is called Fall in Love, Have Children, Stay Put, Save the Planet, Be Happy, and essentially lays out an agenda that says the work balance life ratio is completely out of kilter, and it particularly has become burdensome to women and women of color and many others, in the sense that we are asking women to do everything plus, and men are not doing the heavy lifting alongside when it comes to, let's just take one thing besides pay equity and the obvious stuff. For instance, taking advantage of parental leave and thus giving some cover to women who want to do so, as if somehow this is a woman's prerogative, but men are less involved. And wherever we touch this question and wherever I talk about it in my book, I come down on the side of male allyship. First of all, say at home, as I mentioned to you a moment ago, you know, I'm cooking for three of my five grandchildren today. I do school pickups. I help out. This seems very normal to me. That's the context from which I've been writing. And interestingly enough, folks like the WBC have picked up on some of the things I've been saying. So I've had the privilege of meeting you all. And that's all the introduction I'll give in terms of our collaboration here today. So David and Brad, would one of you and both of you please tell us what the thesis of your book is? When did it come out? What is it about? Lay out your argument for us. And then let's just talk about this work and the whole idea of allyship, and take it in any order you want to do this. Jump in, please.
Yeah. Brad, well, maybe I'll get us started about how we got started, because I think this is the one of the really interesting parts of this that people are curious about. How, again, we have two kind of middle-aged white guys come from a very, you know, traditionally male-dominated profession around the military, and now we're in both in academe and but Brad and I taught together at the Naval Academy for many years, and probably over a decade ago we began our collaboration when we were teaching there together. And one of the things that we both noted, I think, was an overlap and a connection in our research, as well as some personal connection to this work as well around doing gender equity and creating it in the workplace. And, you know, for me as a sociologist, I focus my research in the area of looking at gender work and family issues, so gender perspectives on the career and how family intersects with that. And Brad, as a clinical psychologist, has focused all of his decades of research and scholarship on mentoring relationships and sponsoring relationships, what makes for great mentoring and what mentees say they most appreciate and get the most out of it with those relationships. And one of the things we noted was that there was some overlap in terms of some of the inequities that we see in the workplace and access to things like career developmental resources, sponsoring, advocacy, allyship, mentoring. And so we started out on that adventure, that research program that focused in on the mentoring and sponsoring, because one of the things we noticed early on was that the minute we think about how do we create a more level playing field for women, in this case, and in many industries out there, but it also applies to other minoritized groups, is that the solution tends to be from an organizational perspective. Let's have a women's leadership program or a women's mentoring program, which is great. That's important to help provide those resources. But it's interesting, paradoxically, men look at that and go, well, there's not a place for me in that. I don't have a role or a function in that. And so they don't engage. And we find lots of reasons why men don't engage in doing more of this work. And so we love to reframe this as a leadership issue, where we as men and women all have a role as leaders, and we can have a place in here to create equity. Mm-hmm. So we started doing the research for the first book, which was Athena Rising, How and Why Men Should Mentor Women. Mm-hmm. And that came out in 2016. Interestingly, about a year later, Me Too went widespread, and it really changed the nature of the conversations we were having, and not just focused in on the specific areas of mentoring and sponsoring, but more broadly, how do we show up as allies in the workplace? What does that look like? And what do women say they most appreciate from their allies? And so we set out to do the research for our latest book, Good Guys, How Men Could Be Better Allies for Women in the Workplace. And yeah, we love to share. Both of them are very, very practical books in terms of their evidence-based, but they also provide practical strategies and tactics that we can apply at various levels individually as leaders and certainly as an organization as well. But let me turn it over to Brad. He can tell you a little bit more about the work
that we did. Thank you. That's great. That's a great overview. Brad?
Yeah, and maybe what I'll do for my part here, Frank, is just kind of follow up on some of the headwinds and the obstacles to getting men into the conversation and getting them engaged in relationships with men. I think it was a bit of an epiphany when Dave and I were doing the research for Athena Rising about all the reasons men stay on the sidelines and don't engage, you know. And if we're talking about mentoring kinds of developmental relationships, it often includes things like anxiety, don't want to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, step in it, right? gossip and rumors? What if I'm spending time with a woman at work as a mentor? Will people start talking? Lots of implicit bias. I think this is tougher because we're not even aware of this, but this, you know, there's this women are wonderful effect in psychology where you ask men, hey, what do you think of women? And you get nothing but apparently positive responses to that. Like, oh, women are great. They're kind, they're gentle, they're caring. But what you're not hearing in that narrative are women are competent. They're terrific leaders. And if I'm not thinking that way about women, of course, I might not offer mentoring or sponsoring. So all of that was going on. And then, you know, as Dave alluded, Me Too came along in 2017. And we've been watching, I think, with some chagrin, all of the false narratives about Me Too. You know, women are dangerous or scary. You can't have a closed door meeting with them. Really pretty ridiculous when you remember what Me Too was actually about. Women would love to come to work and not be assaulted or harassed. Super low bar for all of us dudes to get over. But instead of that, we're inundated with these false narratives that women are scary, which is just not true. We've looked at the data. It's incredibly rare for a woman to make a false accusation. So we love to remind men, hey, if you have anxiety, there's only one cure for that, and that's exposure therapy, right? More interaction, more coffee, more mentoring, really. And I need to make that my responsibility, not put that on her to try and solve my reluctance. So just a little background about some of the headwinds we found early on.
Yeah, and I want to take these issues one by one and really look at them. But before we do, one more kind of general overview, and either of you take this. Since these two books came out, first of all, what has been the reaction within corporate America, or non-reaction if they've been ignored? What have been the opportunities that have presented themselves to you to speak to not just the converted at the WBC in a call with mostly women, as you and I were on, but to folks who really need to hear this and have done nothing about it or not aware? Have you seen any change? That's one question. And then the second is, what has been the reaction generally? In other words, you know, were the books reviewed? Did anybody pay attention? Are corporations buying these and making their executives read them? Have they opened up opportunities for you to do, you know, talks at Google, whatever it may be? Can you just tell me how these books have played, just as books, and their influence or lack of? And whether you feel frustrated or vindicated, how's that rolling for you? And okay, throw one more thing into the mix. And how has that played out? Because of course, what you've been doing has also been in the context of the whole COVID thing. So you got an extra wrinkle thrown into the thing, everything from childcare, blah, blah, blah. We know that it's been very complicated. So either of you just kind of please give me an overview of how it's all playing in those contexts. Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. If you appreciate my cultural and political commentary, please do me a favor and subscribe to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. You can subscribe for free, or you can kick in a couple of dollars a month and help me out and help me keep this going if you're able. Either way, I'm incredibly grateful for your support and most of all for your participation. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy as we move toward November of 2024. And every subscription helps create, build, sustain, and put voice to this movement for truth. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, maybe I can start with the surprise about this. And maybe Dave, you can talk about more of how we've been pulled in to different conversations. But I think the big surprise in terms of how the book was received, landed, and maybe more important, Frank, who buys the book? Mm-hmm. You know, Dave and I ostensibly wrote both books for men, right? This is, we do our research by going out and interviewing hundreds of women. Yes. And we ask them behavioral questions. Hey, what have you seen men do that you really appreciate? And we aggregate all that and want to give it away to men as sort of a toolbox about how to show up and be better. So that was the intent. But guess who ends up buying the books? It's mostly women, predominantly. And I think that's been a bit of an eye-opener for us. And our publisher early on sort of warned us that, hey, you guys need to be aware, men don't buy relationship books. Just be aware of that. So, and I think that's really kind of played out. So often what happens is if we're invited to speak or people want to buy our book and have us talk about it, no surprise, it's often women. It's the women's network. It's a women's ERG. It's a women's conference. And then they'll invite men to the event. And we found that to be working. You know, we often end up in front of large audiences, but it often gets instigated by women in those organizations. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that's a bad thing. I see things shifting. I see more men showing up. I see more interest in allyship because I think what we're finding is that those organizations who really get this and lead on it and more men are taking part in gender equity, those are the companies that are recruiting top talent, you know, especially female talent and keeping them, right? Avoiding attrition. Mm-hmm. So that I think is what I've noticed. But Dave, in terms of the pandemic and how we get invited in, what's your sense of that?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Frank, and that it's interesting that because of the timing and what else was going on, of course, in around the world, other events made a difference. And I feel like when Athena Rising came out, we had great reviews of the book. We had lots of great speaking opportunities, and we spoke at every major women's conference, you know, in the United States and then a few outside, and lots of corporations bringing us in to do a lot of this work. Mm-hmm. But it was really interesting. So as we were moving on to the second book, For Good Guys, so that all the research and all the writing and all of that happened prior to the beginning of COVID. But then while the book was at press, COVID hit. And I think like you and many other authors and people out there, when you have a book getting ready to launch and you have everything lined up for the launch, and then all of a sudden something like COVID happens, it's like everything got shut down, of course, right? And we were really concerned about what's the response going to be, what's going to happen. A lot of, you know, a lot more unknowns than there were anything. But, you know, the book launched in October of 2020. So there was time there for organizations, society broadly, to begin to sort itself out a little bit and figure out how do we live in a pandemic world. And interestingly, I feel like we have been able to do maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 times as much speaking and workshops and talking about this topic because of the pandemic, because we were virtual for most of it until recently. And we did a lot more. And I think the other thing that kind of aligned with it was the timing of between things like Me Too and Black Lives Matter, the George Floyd murder, lots of things happening along there where organizations suddenly were thrust into the, you've got to quit talking nice about this and actually do something. Mm-hmm. And we need to work toward this. And so companies and organizations broadly are out there looking for solutions, and a lot of them have reached out to us to use our our books as a way to move forward in those kinds of very practical actions that they could begin taking at various levels of the organization. So, I think we were a little concerned when it all hit, but I think today we look back and go, wow, you know, the way timing of events worked out, it actually played out very well, I think, for the messaging around the book.
Well, now that we've set it up a little bit by talking about the context and so forth, let's dive into the subject, not so much of just the books, I don't mean to minimize them, but the subject itself of allyship. The three of us have been part of some forums where this has been discussed in depth. I did one just the other week with a wonderful outfit called Hey Mama, which was a group of people who are currently in the mothering phase of their life and working within corporate America. And then, of course, there's the Women's Business Collaborative and many other groups. But let's take a minute and just talk about allyship as if we were presenting this to folks who had not thought of this and way past mentoring. Let's just begin with some examples that have stuck in my mind. I'll give you one from, I think one of you guys said this in one of the presentations or someone else said it, quoting you, but just this idea of being the person in the room when a woman is speaking and you're a male in a leadership position in a room and she's being sort of passed over to say, wait a minute, you know, Nancy had a really good idea there, and make sure that that's accounted for, or something as simple as this thing that there's a name for it. You guys can remind me what it is, but this phenomena when a woman brings up an idea and it is ignored, and 2 minutes later some guy in the room says the same thing, and all of a sudden it's a great idea, and say, well, wait a minute, didn't Jane already say that? Or even more important, I'll give you a third one that again I think came from you all, and that is what said when women are not in the room. When someone's being disparaged or discussed and there's three guys talking in the restroom or wherever it may be, and someone says something offhand, and say, hey, you know, what did you just say? And what do you mean by that? And actually call people on it. All three of these sort of things take a little bit of courage, take the ability to be a little bit unpopular. And then I think it was you who said that surprisingly, sometimes other men will speak up and say, hey, I'm glad you said that. I was feeling the same thing, but I hadn't said anything.
Yep.
So have I set up a way that you two can riff on this subject with a lot more knowledge than I have, but I've gleaned a little bit from your work? Did I reflect a few of the points you talk about?
You set us up for the next 45 minutes, Frank.
Good. Well, let's go for it.
Go ahead. Jump in, Dave. I'll follow your lead.
Yeah. So broadly, you know, I think this is important too, that we kind of operationalize allyship, because for some people, it's a term that maybe it's new, or they just have different ideas. And some people have, in different cultures, have different connotations about the term as well. And so when we talk about it, we have a very specific way, and we look at it in kind of three key areas. And the first is interpersonal allyship. And this is really thinking about how do we show up in the workplace and the kinds of relationships we're having, and developing awareness of how others are experiencing the workplace, so that we can begin to notice those things that you mentioned, right? A lot of these different gender dynamics and other dynamics that play out in group settings, you know, it's really hard to fix these if we can't see them, or we don't understand them, and we're not. And so the interpersonal part is kind of the foundation, the basis for this. And this is the easy part, because you only have to worry about, you know, kind of holding yourself accountable for doing that work. The hard part gets into the next level, and that's the public part that you were talking about. And now this is where a lot of the men that we interviewed, this is where they said they really felt like they were putting some skin in the game now, because now I'm putting myself out there. I'm holding others accountable, holding people on my team, my leaders. And then the last part, the hardest part of allyship, is systemic allyship. And this is where now, as you develop that awareness, you understand how these things operate, you're seeing how they're impacting people in your organization. Now you have an obligation to change those practices. What are those everyday cultural practices, the things that we do, and all the different employment processes we have and everything else? How do we change those to make them more equitable for everyone to thrive? And that's really, you know, the hardest part. But let me start back at the interpersonal. And so you brought up a few of those out there. And what makes this really challenging is that sometimes we just don't see it. We don't understand it. Sometimes we think we're doing the work, but we may be in other ways overestimating how much we're really doing, or the impact that we're having and the kind of work that we're doing. And so, you know, I think there's some hesitancy, as Brad said earlier, about kind of a reluctancy to put ourselves out there and to do some of this. And the notion that you gave, the scenario with the, you know, having a woman's idea, basically she puts it out there and it's stolen by another guy. And so the term we probably used was, that we learned from women, was bro-appropriation.
Right. So, bro-appropriation. That's it.
And Brad, I had never heard that term until several women told us that, but they also said it could be heap-eating or imitating. But anyway, it just goes to show you how prevalent that is. But we heard so many examples of that when this happening to women. And it was frustrating, because I had, at that point, had never seen it happen. And I certainly had never experienced it myself. So really hard in this case to understand and do what do I do? How do I can't even see it when it's happening. So now that I'm aware, now I can decide how I'm going to handle it right there in the moment. So that interpersonal part is really developing the awareness so that you can begin to notice, you can begin to recognize. And I think the big caveat here, before I'll let Brad talk a little bit about public or systemic allyship, is that we have to caution men in particular about the fact that we're often kind of socialized that, hey, when we see a problem and to fix it, right, we jump in, and it often turns into kind of rescuing. And this happens around some socialized gender roles as well. Mm-hmm. And this is not about rescuing. And we just want to reiterate that. And it's not about going in and mansplaining this to women. Right. This is about us, you know, listening, learning, becoming more aware, and then coming alongside, partnering with women, collaborating with women, and really beginning to understand how can we partner together to solve this, because this is not a women's issue. This is an us issue that we all have to work on.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, I'll follow up on some of the disruption piece that you were alluding to, Frank, which I think is so important. And you mentioned something really important, and that is that there's actually good data in the psychological research literature showing that men have misperceptions about how widespread sexist attitudes are among other men. Hmm. So when that sexist comment drops on a table in the meeting, a lot of men feel uncomfortable with it. They know that didn't land the right way with them, but they don't believe that other men share their concern. They think they're the only one in the room. What you find is that when, just as you alluded, one guy disrupts, right, and says, hey, that's not okay with me, or what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. Suddenly it unglues, as it were, a lot of other men in the room, you know, and they may join you right there in the confrontation, or they may come to you later and say, hey, I'm really glad you said something about that. That bothered mm-hmm. me too. Mm-hmm. But it often takes somebody to do this. And mm-hmm. this whole thing also aligns with a whole nother stream of research, and that's all the bystander research in social psychology. You know, we find that if you're in that meeting, some guy makes some egregiously sexist comment, everyone probably cringes, or a lot of people do. They feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. After about 3 seconds, something called bystander paralysis sets in. And after that moment, pretty much the opportunity's lost. Nobody's going to disrupt it after that much time. So even though we felt uncomfortable, and we may think of a great response to it later on sometime, the moment to really disrupt that is lost. And mm-hmm. so Dave and I love this thing that we call the 2-second rule. You know, hey, within 2 seconds, you just got to say something. And you may not know what that is yet, but how about just saying, ouch, right? The beauty of that is it buys me a few more seconds while everyone in the room looks at me or on the virtual meeting. Mm-hmm. And now I can think about what we call my I statement, right? How am I going to own that I'm not okay with what was just said? Because too often, you probably hear this, Frank, men, if he does disrupt, he'll then follow up with something unhelpful like, hey, man, there are women in the room. You can't talk that way. No, really not a helpful ally intervention versus, hey, I didn't find that funny, or we don't do that here in this organization, or, you know, I don't appreciate the way you just demean my female colleagues, but I got to own it. I think that men assume that if I confront, I have to get all DEFCON 6, you know, combative and mixed martial arts fighter.
Yeah,
that's not what we're talking about. You know, how about this whole idea of carefrontation? You know, so I could say in the meeting, hey, Frank, man, you're better than that. You know, mm-hmm. I expect better. I know you, and that's not you. Or I could come to you after the meeting and close the door and say, hey, Frank, that's not going to work. You know, you've got to be better. And I share this with you because I'm a colleague who cares about you, and I want you to be better. But that didn't land well today when you said it, and it's not good for our team when you mm-hmm. do that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's very helpful. I'm going to just pause to remind people that you are listening to and or watching In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, a podcast, and that today my guests are David Smith and Brad Johnson, who are authors of books we are talking about. One was in the Navy. Or were you both in the service? You mentioned it as if you had both been, or were you both at Annapolis? Not Annapolis, the Naval Academy. Forgive me. Can you correct me, Brad? I've got this wrong.
Yeah. We were both in the Navy. The big difference is I was in just for a few years as a medical officer, and Dave was in his whole career as a pilot. So he's kind of a real Navy guy.
Yeah. Brad, were you a corpsman?
No, I was a clinical psychologist.
Oh, okay. So you were doing that even back then, right?
I was.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Good. Well, listen, I'm gonna change gears here a little bit. And just having reintroduced you, speaking of which, by the way, do either of you have the actual hard copy of one of your books or both of them handy there? Because I don't have a cover to show here. We're going to give links to your books on Amazon or wherever.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, you want to just haul one up and let me look at it? Forgive me, because I've been doing too much online here. Just show me that. You got it? Yes. Good guys. Yeah, there we are.
There we go.
Instead of going, no, it's getting a little blurry with the.
I'm gonna turn off my blur if I can here.
Yeah, the tech thing is too clever for us.
Oh, yeah.
That's good.
Okay.
Good, there we go. So, good guys. Just read the subtitle again from the actual book cover.
So, yeah, it's good guys, and it's how men can become better allies for women in the workplace.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Good. Nice cover. But I just wanted to show that. So let me shift gears a little bit, and I'll sort of give you a little anecdotal story here myself, because I'm fishing for something from each of you on a more personal level. I was raised in an evangelical fundamentalist background by missionary parents living in Europe. And my own journey goes from that kind of right-wing paternal view that was passed on to me of men being in charge of everything to a long journey that brought me to a more progressive position on a lot of issues. I have a son who served in the Marine Corps, fought in Afghanistan. Actually, I spoke at the Naval Academy one time when we were doing a book together called Keeping Faith, a Father-Son Story About Love in the United States Marine Corps. And so I got invited to a bunch of places to talk as a military parent. So we have a little intersection there. But my own journey toward what you might call a mindset of allyship began on several levels. One was I just happened to notice that all the women in my life who I worked with professionally, my doctor, my lawyer, a number of other women that I worked with, my editors, these were the most competent people in my life. And I began to have a bias simply based on self-preservation of trying to work with women whenever possible, because quite frankly, with a few exceptions, I have found that most of the women, Ernie, I'm not including you here, but most of the people I work with closely who are women are the people who I actually have come to rely on to be the most steady presence in whatever field it is. My best editor, my agent has always been a woman, my lawyer is a woman, my general practitioner doctor is a woman. So that has nothing to do with business or feminism or enlightenment. It just has to do with, you know, I'm pushing 70 and having learned a few things along the way. Then I have a daughter, Jessica, who is the CEO of an investment company in New York City. And when she was working in Europe, she would turn on her cell phone sometimes in meetings in France and other places so I could, hear what was going on. And after the meetings, she was a lobbyist for energy companies in Europe with the European Union. And I found after she would do a business trip, half our meetings were her telling me how she had to plan escape routes from business meetings with men who would then expect her to go out and have a drink with them and hit up on her. And it was in a kind of an abuse, but from a father's perspective. So that's sort of chapter two. And then chapter three is the political one. And that is, you know, I consider myself to be a progressive Democrat. That's neither here nor there. But from that perspective, the Trump years put things very sharply in focus to me in terms of the kind of male leadership, whether it's Bolsonaro in Brazil or Trump or Modi or Putin or all these other authoritarian figures, were so much the opposite of the direction that I'd found my own life going in my regard for women in my life. And then the last penny to drop here is that in my own relationship with my wife, Jeannie, I had seen such a difference over the years of what I brought to that relationship as a young married man brought up where in an evangelical background that taught that women were supposed to obey men and the tremendous light that dawned within our relationship when I changed that view, you know, sincerely and made amends for some really horrible years together that she patiently strove through to a better place, a real kind of repentance in the true sense of the word of a change of heart and a change of behavior. So that's kind of brings me to where I have been writing about the subject and speaking about it. And it's not detached for me. It's not academic. It's rooted in a personal life journey where I actually changed my mind and behavior and didn't bring it to any position of perfection, but understand how woefully bad it was at one point, and I'm sorry for the language, but you know, this is my podcast. But honestly, the way I was raised was basically to become an asshole by divine right. In other words, that not only are you an asshole, but God likes you better when you're bullying women because you're in charge because the Bible put you there. And I left that. So that's kind of brutal, but I'm going to toss it out. And now I'm going to shut up for the rest of this interview and say, okay, you can take turns or swap off on this, but I know you both have personal journeys because we all do. What is your personal journey to where you are today on this issue? Whoever wants to lead off.
Yeah. Dave, go ahead. Why don't you lead off and I'll follow you.
Yeah. And this is really important, Frank, because what we find is that for several reasons, it's important for us to understand in our ally journey, our why, our purpose, the motivation for doing this work. And, you know, we found this almost, it started out in conversations just like yours, because it's wrapped up, it's interwoven in the context of who we are, right? And what we believe and why we believe it. And I think that that's important. So in all the interviews we had, we heard this from the men that we talked to, and it's really important because I think one, it helps us to understand our own commitment to doing this work. It's helpful when people push back and they begin to question you as a public ally in your doing of this work about why are you doing this? You know, because you're not a member of that group. So there's got to be something, there's a reason why. Mm-hmm. And I think from a leadership perspective, this is really important. We find that senior leaders, their personal narrative around this is very helpful in helping them to overcome some of the discomfort they often have in talking about things like gender or race or diversity in their organization. So telling that authentic personal narrative and then connecting it back into their own business, really powerful when they do that. Brad and I found this to be so important that as we wrapped up all the research and the writing of the book, that we were putting the foreword together and we said, well, we've got to start with our why. And so when you open up Good Guys, you'll find our why is in the front of the book because it is so important. You know, for me, it really started early in the beginning of my career in the military. My partner, my wife, is also a naval officer. She's also retired. We had parallel careers back in the 80s, and when we started. And of course, you know, there were even fewer women in the military back then. And of course, we would talk about our experiences and what was going on sometimes at home over dinner. And I just was always amazed at how different our experiences were at work, and how for me it wasn't even a question about being accepted or being a part of the organization or being valued and for my expertise, but for my wife it was a question every day that she had to prove it, and there were you know, obstacles put in her way. And you know, when I was looking for career advice or guidance or what should I do next in my career, I didn't have to go look very far. As a matter of fact, I usually didn't have to look. For her, it was like you thought you were, you know, looking for the Holy Grail out there somewhere, right? It's like, where is this? Where is this information? Can't get to it. And so it was really frustrating. And of course, you know, one of the things we often hear is that personal connection to doing this work that is so important, because it gets in touch with that sense of fairness that we have, that sense of justice. And that's a powerful motivating tool for behavioral change. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was, well, okay, I have this data point with an important person in my life, but let me go back in and look in my own organization. Do I see this happening? Mm-hmm. Talk to my female colleagues. And sure enough, yeah, I made the connection. I was like, wow, so this is a really systemic issue. And how, you know, how am I a part of that? And how am I going to be better at making it better for everyone? And so that was the beginning of my journey. And then much later on, as I was going through graduate school, my PhD work, my dissertation advisor, who we used to have a lot of great conversations about this topic, and because my dissertation was closely related to it. And she said, but you do realize that, you know, you're still part of the problem. I'm mm-hmm. like, what do you mean? I'm one of the good guys, right? I don't know that I would have said that, but but the behavior, there were certain language, certain perceptions, assumptions, and things that I would do. And she's like, yeah, that's all part of the problem, right? And I was just almost indignant about it. And the great thing about grad school is you get some time to reflect and a little introspection. And I realized that, you know, she's right. And I've got to become better. You know, then this is why allyship is a journey. It's not a destination. We're constantly learning. Brad and I are constantly learning along the way, even since we've been doing our own research. And so for me, that was a big wake up call to have somebody, again, somebody very, a female, you know, senior to me, expert in our field, somebody who I, you know, I look up to and really value her expertise and guidance. And it made me think hard about it. And so really, again, a great motivator for me as well. But that's kind of been my journey up to where we began doing our research.
Yeah. And I think for me, Frank, you know, there's some overlap here. I think for me, probably this began actually with my academic interests and all of my research and mentoring. Noticing that decades of research showed that women had less access to mentorship. Even if they got mentored, they often didn't get sponsored as part of that. You know, men can be reluctant to loudly champion women. That can feel awkward for them. We've mentioned all the reasons men maybe don't lean into mentoring in the first place. So I was always a bit perplexed by that, having been somebody who has mentored men and women in my career. So that was a curiosity. And then like Dave, I think there are women in my life. And the biggie probably for me is my sister. I have one sibling. You know, we both entered the Navy as clinical psychologists. My sister stayed in her entire career. She's still in. She's a Navy captain. She's been a commanding officer, 3 combat deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, aircraft carrier duty. My sister's done it all. And yet, in all of my conversations with her, like Dave, it has become crystal clear to me that her experiences, even though she and I have a very similar interpersonal style, are quite different, right? Mm-hmm. So she is told often she should smile more. You know, if she gives men direct feedback, she's called emasculating. Mm-hmm. If she is too much the other direction, she's, you know, people say, hey, you're kind of maternal. So that tightrope that she has to constantly walk as a senior leader, I never have to pretzel myself that way. And then, you know, there's another dimension, I think, for both David and me, and that is we taught together for almost a decade at the Naval Academy. And I will just say, I don't think there's any way you can work at a place like a United States Service Academy and be exposed to the young women that we bring on board, who after just 4 years are going out leading Marines and sailors in combat as officers, and not be astounded at how talented they are and what terrific leaders they are. And so, you know, Dave and I have commented before, we wish everyone in the country could come to the service academies and meet some of the women we get to have in class every day. I think it would just be such a change, especially for men, in the way they see women in the workplace. So I think that was part of our background too. We just, you know, through that exposure and the privilege of teaching at a place like Annapolis, we just have had a different perception about where women belong and what they can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for that. This is In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, and I am talking to authors David Smith and Brad Johnson about their books on gender equity, but a particular aspect of that, of allyship. And that is being the good guys, as the title of one of their books puts it, and really standing up for gender equity, but doing far more than that, being a voice on the male side of things that becomes a genuine ally of women, not because it's the right thing to do, but because it actually is the better thing to do. It is good for business. You know, it's funny that you bring up that example about the military. I remember visiting my son after boot camp at one of the places he had gone for training in signals intelligence, before he was deployed. and sort of facetiously said to him, and this is quite a long time ago, this was in just after 9/11, so however many years ago that is. And I said, how are the women Marines doing in this platoon? And he looked at me and very unsmilingly said, they could kick your ass, Dad. and it was, you know, at that point, it was interesting that he had that reaction. He was kind of defensive. And I had asked the question a little bit facetiously, but not, but, you know, I was genuinely curious, how is it all working? But even as a young Marine, he had that sense of solidarity, which was like, you know, hey, this is a fellow Marine we're talking about here. And that was his reaction. So he had kind of learned the lesson that you, I mean, he's 19 at this point, and he's feeling the way you felt right there, having been there. Of course, the women's platoon down at Parris Island goes through with their own training, but they start working together afterwards. So anyway, that was his experience. Just turn the page here a little bit in terms of being observers of women in the workplace and their battles, and then the fact that if you look at the actuarial tables from places like Iceland and Switzerland and countries that have made bigger strides in terms of gender equity, it turns out that men actually live longer in those cultures than they do in ours. It turns out there's a less of a suicide rate. It turns out that there are a lot of benefits for the male cohort in the corporate world, not to mention profitability of corporations and so forth. It seems to me that you all are probably running into quite a bit of evidence out there in many, many different related fields of the fact that aside from any moral issue of this is the right thing to do, even if you were only interested in corporate profits, you would be fighting for gender equity and respect for women who do, you know, not even a comparable job, often a better job of leadership in the workplace. Talk a little bit about how this actually pays out in dollars and cents and longevity and health and mental health and male suicide or lack thereof and all these other pathologies that we suffer from that are somehow related to attitudes that also show themselves in the kind of sexism on an everyday basis women run into. It's actually better for men, aside from anything else, even if our motivation was purely selfish, a kind of a selfish altruism. If both of you want to jump in on any of those aspects, I'd really love to hear you talk.
Yeah, boy, we have a lot to say on this. You know, maybe I'll just mention a couple of things, Frank. And I think, you know, you alluded to the business bottom line profit issue. And I think at this point, I'm astounded that we even have to continue talking about this with men in corporate America. We still do, because I still ask the question, what's in it for my company? The data is so overwhelming at this point. And it used to be just correlational, right? Companies that had more women in senior leadership, more gender balance up into the C-suite, they tended to do better correlationally. Now we have causal data. You know, new studies out of Stanford and other places show that as you increase a proportion of women in leadership, your company just makes more money. You're just more profitable. So I wish that was sort of settled law at this point. But, you know, I think we're making progress on that. I think the way I often describe it, and I think you were alluding to this, Frank, that if you just think of the things that make somebody effective as a leader, and you think about the kind of personnel you want on board that's going to be good for your company, think of things like intellectual level, IQ, but we also think about emotional intelligence. We think about creativity. These things are spread across gender. So when you're not fully incorporating women, essentially what you're doing is taking half the people at the top of the curve on all those, you know, dimensions I just mentioned, and you're excluding them from your workforce. And then you're mystified at maybe why you're not getting the performance you want, or why you're not as competitive with groups that are much more inclusive and have more women on board. So that's kind of how I think about it, just how self-sabotaging and undermining it is when we don't fully incorporate women at all levels and find ways to do that, whatever that requires. In terms of, you know, the outcomes, I mean, I would just talk about, and I know Dave has a bunch of other pieces he can incorporate in here, but I would just talk about the workplace environment. You know, if you look at measures of quality of workplace environment, places people want to work, there are often places that have women in leadership. Mm. And no surprise, what you find is the leadership's more democratic. Mm. It's more inclusive. People feel involved in decisions that are made. They feel consulted. They feel cared for fundamentally. That's what happens to the culture when more women are leading. Mm-hmm. And ironically, men and women say they want to work in those kinds of places. Mm-hmm. So to your point, there's a lot in this for us just in terms of quality of work life integration. We just see that in the evidence. So, in terms of a place to go to work, I'm going to enjoy it a lot more if there are more women leading. But Dave, other things we see in this for men that top of mind for you?
Yeah. You know, and this is back to the why again, as well, the motivation to do this work, that we see some men who will tell you that, hey, that's just part of my leadership brand, part of who I am as a leader, as a person, right? And how I lead, how do I motivate, how do I take care of people? And I find that finding ways to make the workplace more equitable for everyone, right? That's what we do. And so they look at their allyship from that lens. The interesting thing is that we find with these leaders, and there's some great research out there now that shows that you know, CEOs today who are succeeding out there, more and more of these CEOs, I think it was like 62% of them now today, they embody these traits around empathy, around listening skills, and higher EQ and collaboration and, you know, authenticity, showing vulnerability. And those were not things that, you know, our generation, when we came up in the the 20th century workplace and maybe our fathers and grandfathers, you know, that was not part of that leadership style. That was all about, you know, power dynamics and authority and top down leadership and do what I say. And, you know, that's not what motivates people today. That is not what the 21st century workplace is all about. And CEOs and senior leaders today, you can see that evolution happening. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is that it tends to overlap with what is often more traditionally stereotypically looked at as a women's leadership style. Mm-hmm. And which is what we find in the research for decades now, is that people most appreciate, most value those qualities, those traits from a leader's perspective that women embody more often than men. Mm-hmm. So I think we're seeing some of that shift happening in the workplace, which is really helpful and interesting. But, you know, it also overlaps with some of the research, you know, that Brad and I have done from, we started with the mentoring part of it. And one of the things we saw was around kind of workplace relationships broadly. The best ones out there are not those top down, not all about power. They're all about being much more mutual or reciprocal relationships, more of a give and take, and there's learning. It's not about, we're more of colleagues, right? Yeah, I know you're senior to me, but, you know, we work together as colleagues. Interestingly, when we find in the research is that those kind of relationships have a lot of great benefits for everyone, including the senior person. Mm-hmm. And in our research, we found that they had an increased access to information. They had more diverse networks. And I think the best part for us as leaders, men, that, hey, you have better interpersonal skills. So more empathy, higher EQ, better communication skills. And again, that makes you a better leader. But the nice thing is that it makes you a better person. So you get to take that home and makes you a better partner and a better parent as well. And so we're beginning these workplace relationships. They don't happen in isolation, just in the workplace. They bleed over into the home. And I think that's the part that's missing too, is we have to remember that if we're going to be allies, if we're going to be these kinds of leaders at work, then we have to be doing this at home as well. Mm-hmm. And doing it for our partners and doing it for our kids, for those who are parents out there, much like you were talking about at the very beginning, right? Of how I do these things at work, the things that are at home, the things that I do at home also bleed over and they change my behavior in the workplace too. Mm-hmm. It makes me more relatable because I can talk about family issues. And gosh, when I have a home responsibility at home, I go, hey guys, gotta go. You know, I got a sick kid. I got to go take to the doctor. I got to stay home today. I'll catch up with you later. And just like your book, you know, we begin to prioritize things differently and make that it more acceptable in the workplace, which again, changes and shifts the culture for everyone.
Yeah. And it's a different kind of allyship because you're not sort of ascending, leaving women out there twisting in the wind as if they're the only people who care about family, which of course is not true. But the male hubristic kind of image is, hey, you know, I've got to pretend that it's all about work. And of course it never is. You know, some of the hardest ass men I've ever known, you know, as soon as you get past that, they have the same, exactly the same level of care for their families. It's just, they're not allowed, you know, they feel they haven't been allowed to show it. And women too. You know, I remember my daughter talking about the fact that she made a conscious decision at one point to tell the truth as a CEO of an investment company in New York City to other women and people asking her how she came to her position and say, listen, I want to be honest with you. I didn't learn much in the realm of business and even less in university. Where I learned to run a company was being a mother of two children, staying home with them before they were in school, balancing that all out with my career, making all those decisions. And that's where my leadership was formed, almost the willingness to do that. And then talking with some women when I was writing my book about this, how there was a whole generation of women that went as far as even to hide pregnancies or pretend that they weren't, you know, mothers. And then, of course, at the end of life, it's the same thing. People who are involved in elder care, you know, saying, well, I'm at a meeting. What they really are is they're at a home with their mother who has Alzheimer's. Let's get past all this where we'd never admit that we have a human side to our life. I think that's part of allyship. Just some reaction on your part.
Oh, I think you're spot on. And I got to be honest with you, Frank. This is that funny moment when Dave and I are out speaking to groups of men on allyship, right? And you know, we kind of get them stoked about showing up and being more effective at work with their female colleagues. They're ready to throw on their ally cape and go charging into the workplace. And that's when we have to say, whoa. You actually have to start your allyship journey at home. And if you're partnered with a woman, this is especially true because, you know, all the data right now on the pay equity gap shows we have about 200 years to go to close that at our current rate. Well, why is that? Well, look at the data on heterosexual couples, both working full time. Chances are she's doing at least double, if not more, of the domestic work, childcare, homeschooling. And it ought to be just logical and obvious to us that women are never going to be able to share fully in opportunities at work, including opportunities to advance, if men are not sharing more fully at home. And not only this is great for us psychologically, it's good for our kids, but it's also good to getting to gender balance. So Dave and I often tell men, hey, allyship begins by you going home tonight. And if you're partnered with a woman, do a domestic audit. Ask her, am I pulling my weight? And when you get the answer, you can't get defensive. You just got to start thinking about how you're going to start picking up the slack and doing your part of that.
Yeah, here, to which I would add that, you know, at the beginning of this program, I talked a little bit about this book that I wrote, and what it came out of was 13 years of doing childcare for three of my youngest five grandchildren. And not, I don't mean my wife did the childcare and I helped out. I mean that I was in there doing as much as she was, maybe even a little more, if I may say so, in terms of hours spent. But where my book came out of, and what I would always point out to the same group that you're talking to, and I know you say this because you did a moment before, it isn't just a question about gender equity and doing the right thing for your partner if you happen to be in a heterosexual relationship, or for that matter, a gay marriage or anything else. It's the actual benefit you have. I can honestly say, and this is a little Oprah-esque and sugar, you know, this is not sugar-coated, but I can honestly say that the most meaningful parts of my life, as I look back at 70, you know, what stands out is not the first time I got a great review of a novel. It isn't the first time this or that happened. What stands out is that my 13-year-old granddaughter, Lucy, who, by the way, my wife is now driving down to a school event, and I made her lunch today, texts me little messages as one of her best friends and tells me about her life. And we are close. That closeness only exists because I put in the hours. If I was missing out on that, And you rolled the clock back and I'd been too busy or too into my whatever it is that I thought was more important, I would have literally missed the happiest moments I've had in the last 13 years. And so I would just say, you know, I have a little term, altruistic selfishness. You know, don't be a fool. You're never going to wish you'd spend another hour in the office. But I'll tell you what, you know, if you get into the habit of sharing the housework with your partner, and that level of trust and love builds up, and or you put in the hours with the kids, the quality of the relationship you walk away with at the end of the day is what makes me want to get up in the morning. It isn't anything to do with my career. And I honestly mean that. And I know I can't be the only man who feels that way.
Yeah. Wow. We want to bring you along when we speak, Frank. I love that.
Yeah. And I mean, that's heartfelt. It's life experience. And as I mentioned before, I wasn't always that. Hey, there were years I spent 6 months on the road back in my heavy striving days before I learned these lessons. And those are the regrets I have. But having learned some things along the way, I've got to tell you that the message that I bring to other men is don't be stupid, because if you've got this stupid idea of your role and it's all about career, and you walk away with children and grandchildren who aren't your best friends and you don't feel close to, it isn't that you've done the wrong thing in some moral sense, although maybe you could argue that, but you have eaten the wrapper and thrown away the candy. So I feel sorry for men who were stuck with the 20th century idea of what male professionalism was about and missed all that. Mm-hmm. And I just think, you know, the reasons women are so good in these leadership roles is at least they open a window to males to actually live fuller lives, because they care about other things besides mm-hmm. just, you know, and I tend to see in your remarks. Do you think that is in the direction of what you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. And we definitely see that. And you see it in some of those outcomes in the research that you were mentioning earlier. And we see that in terms of marital relationship, you see it in relationship with your children, and just broader in other relationships and life, broad measures of life satisfaction. Like you said, in countries like Iceland and Sweden, yeah. other countries that's more about the culture and how we socialize men and women, yeah. that it makes a significant difference, right, in terms of outcomes, which, and again, you can't diminish the importance of things like life satisfaction, because it does lead to important mental and physical health outcomes like longevity. So,
mm-hmm. yeah. And you know, in terms of just personal experience, my son, who was in the Marine Corps, is a manager at a high-tech company down in Boston. And after COVID, he renegotiated his deal. He says, I've been working great from home for a year and a half for you guys. If you want to keep me in this position, I'll come in on Thursdays, and every other day of the week, I'm working from home, because I can get up in the morning and fix breakfast for my kids. I see them at night instead of being commuting the whole time. It's worked out great for him. And he's discovering in his late 30s, early 40s, what it took me a long time to get to. And he was forced, as it were, to discover it by getting sent home for a year and a half to think about things. And I don't think he's the only man out there who's made this discovery. What have you experienced? What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's funny. I think that especially coming out of the pandemic, Frank, I think a lot of men are saying exactly, and you can look at surveys of men's attitudes about being more involved at home, what they benefited from having more time with childcare and engagement with their kids. The problem we're seeing is that, you know, they're starting to lean into more flex work, more remote work. Let's do some kind of hybrid thing so that I can continue this because I'm really enjoying it. And they're not meeting a favorable response from the workplace. And I think this is going to be kind of a litmus test moment from my perspective. I think what we're going to see are those companies who can move into some kind of flexibility and change expectations about work life are going to retain the best talent. You're already seeing it in attitude surveys about, are you going to stay with your company? Mm-hmm. People are saying outright, if my company doesn't continue to allow me to have flexibility, I'm going to move on, because somebody else will value that.
Yeah, and I think that's both men and women eat quite equally, yep. from what I can see. One last little thing to end on, sort of a quirky note, we'll wrap this up. First of all, like I said earlier, I'm talking with David Smith and Brad Johnson about their books, and we are going to have links to everything. Anywhere this is, there will be links to their books. You will be able to buy them by clicking. So I'm not going to give you lists of things to do. It's all going to be there wherever this is. But, you know, I have a sort of when you look at how the high-tech industry has kind of fallen out of favor within a few years, you know, these were going to be the people who solved everything. These were these great people. They were doing everything. It's interesting. One of the things that unifies them, of course, this is a horrible generalization, is you have this kind of bro culture, and then you have these striding colossuses of white male leadership and so forth. It seems to me that aside from the downside of things like Facebook in terms of involvement with kids and what they've done and the whistleblowers and all this, that the idea of this hubristic titan of industry, male leadership, throwback to the Gilded Age, is rapidly falling out of fashion. And a lot of these billionaires seem to have very wounded egos because nobody loves them anymore. We really don't like our royalty now. I mean, we're on the cusp of another French Revolution, if you want to put it that way. And basically, tech has fallen out of favor. And I just want to throw this out as a last question to both of you. Wouldn't it be interesting if tech had really accommodated female leadership and aspiration? Wouldn't our feeling about tech be different now than it's all just a couple of billionaires always in the news for what they tweeted 2 minutes ago or what they're doing? You know, I don't think we as a culture, that's male and female, I don't think we like that form of leadership anymore. We don't like these people very much. And I think they're taking the good name of their industry down with them. I'm just tossing that out as an off the cuff remark. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, it's interesting because there are a couple, you know, some big names that tend to make headlines. But
yeah.
Brad and I, of course, get to work with lots of companies that are, and leaders who really are trying to make cultural change. And that's what keeps us hopeful, gives us hope and gets us up in the morning to think about, all right, you know, working with these people and really creating the kind of change that they're looking for and recognizing that, hey, well, the way things used to be, that can't be the way it is anymore, right? We're being held accountable for this, whether it's from our boards, from our customers, from other stakeholders, from our employees, to be able to talk about these things and to do it in a way that shows that we connect and we care and that we're all in this together, right? Where it's not just about me in this case. Mm-hmm. And so that's, we're very hopeful, and that keeps me optimistic about where we're headed with both, not just tech, but I think, you know, a lot of traditionally male dominated industries and professions out there, including the military and law and finance, and, you know, there's all other STEM industries as well, that there are people who get it and they are trying to change things.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that that's another good argument for making sure women have a shot at female leadership within the corporate realm, because it's a relief to run into someone who thinks that way. And I tend to find that more often with some of the women leaders that I know than the males. What do you think, Brad?
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And you know, I think I would just sum it up. When I think about the leaders who are men who are really getting this right, Frank, I see them showing up with this incredibly refreshing humility. You know, you've mentioned hubris several times, and it really is the opposite end of the spectrum, that I don't have all the answers. I just know that I value these people who work with me, and I'm so impressed with their talent, and they've got answers I don't. I need to listen. I need to show up and not assume I know what the right answer is going to be in terms of where we go as a company. I want to listen to my people. I want to find out what they need, and I may have to change things that I believe. I may have to change the way I lead, but I know this is the right thing to do. So I see that humility just, you know, saturating the behavior of the leaders that I really admire right now.
Yeah. And I guess, and you could add as a footnote, the ones who seem to be destined to dominate the future more than the older model, if right. I take what you were saying before, is that correct?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's just paradoxically, right? Not knowing, having humility, having curiosity and a learning orientation, that's how we're going to lead and win, I think, versus, you know, the top-down autocratic approach.
Well, that's a good note to end on. So David Smith, Brad Johnson, thank you so much. There are links to your books wherever this is showing up, and we've had a really good discussion. Thank you so much for the time. And really, above all, thank you for spearheading some of this in terms of breaking this issue wide open and doing so much to help raise the consciousness of me and other people who are listening to you and reading you and corporate America and all the rest of it. So many, many thanks for the time. I hope to see you out there on the trail or on Zoom.
Whichever. Thanks for a great conversation, Frank.
Thanks for including us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In Conversation with Frank Schaefer is a production of the George Bailey Morality and Public Life Fellowship. It is produced by Ernie Gregg and hosted by Frank Schaefer, author of Fall in Love, Have Children, Stay Put, Save the Planet, Be Happy, a post-pandemic blueprint for rebalancing work and family in favor of love and living. To learn more and support the show, please visit lovechildrenplanet.com.